Welcome to Chicago Musician. I'm your host, Sean Stengel. Today, my guest is Jeremy Kahn. He's a wonderful pianist with a wide range of experience from the Broadway pits to symphony orchestras to the jazz world. He's also quite a funny guy, so get ready for some pithy wit and some witty pith. Probably. Welcome to episode 4 of Chicago Musician. Today is Saturday, March 26, 2022. I'm excited to talk to my friend and colleague, Jeremy Kahn, but first I'd like us all to travel back for a moment to the summer of 1969. Actually, the year 1969. I'm going to talk about two films that I think should be required viewing in schools, and certainly for anyone interested in music on any level. And those are the documentary The Beatles Get Back and Summer of Soul, which has a subtitle of Or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised. So The Beatles, one you've probably heard of, Peter Jackson got a hold of 60 hours of footage from when the Beatles were making Let It Be and what ended up being their last ever live performance together. It's a 9-hour, three-part documentary now on Disney Plus. I think it's still only on Disney Plus. But it is amazing. I'm just a hair too young to really have been hip enough to be a Beatles fan back in the day. I was aware of them, but, you know, I know of them, and I know most of their songs, or a lot of their songs now, because how can you not? But this documentary, I think it starts a little bit slowly. It's the Beatles. They want to rehearse and perform 14 new songs. And besides that, the goal of what they're trying to do is sort of nebulous. A performance, an album, a being, a concert. Is it going to be in Libya? But the window into the biggest rock band of all time, and probably the most influential or one of the most influential of all time, it's really fascinating. I mean, when this is made, 1969, the Beatles are all in their 20s. They're at the peak of their fame. They're still together, although they break up the next year or something. And actually, this footage was originally filmed and made into another documentary. The original director was Michael Lindsay Hogg, and he made a documentary called Let It Be. And I was reading up on this a little bit because the impression of it is it was very dark, and it was about the Beatles breaking up and fighting, and it showed the coming apart of the biggest rock band ever. But then I read a little bit more, and the director himself said he felt like that's not really what that first documentary was like, but it came out right after the Beatles broke up. And so everybody saw it through that lens. When George sort of gently quits the band for a few days, you know, it's the undoing of the Beatles. And because Yoko was at all the sessions, Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles. But Peter Jackson has taken this same material and made a really wonderful, insightful series of films, I guess. And you watch the Beatles just be themselves. And you get to see them making up songs. You know, Paul is just noodling on the guitar, and you hear a riff that turns into Get Back. It might be the first time he ever played it. And then, you know, they sing dummy lyrics and they search for the ones we all know what they are now, but they didn't know then, and they come upon them. And that's why I think it's required viewing. If you've ever been in a band or created music, the process of how it happens is mysterious and crazy. And to hear some of the greatest songs ever form and evolve, and then watch these four guys who are clearly friends. It's very cordial and jokey. It's heartbreaking in a way. John Lennon is so funny and unusual. And McCartney is a little bossy, but he's so smart. And Ringo's just kind of what we know Ringo now. He's just there. He's chill. He's positive. And George is, I guess from what I understand, the youngest Beatle. And here he's coming into his own a little bit. He's sort of a quiet member, but it's hard to get heard when there's Lennon and McCartney in the room. Anyhow, it's really, really a wonderful film. The second film is Summer of Soul, directed by Questlove. A lot of you know him as being the front man for The Roots on Jimmy Fallon's Tonight Show, but he's obviously a lot more than just a drummer. He's put together, again, it's not unlike Get Back. There was footage of an entire summer of the Harlem Cultural Festival, or like 6 weeks in the summer of 1969, where there was a music festival outside in Harlem. And they filmed hours and hours of footage, and then for 50 years, no one saw it. The guy who filmed it tried to, you know, get people interested in seeing it, but unfortunately, it was the same summer as Woodstock, the most famous of all music festivals. And it just got buried by that. He even tried to market it as the Black Woodstock at some point, and no one would buy it. So 50 years go by, and now Questlove has resurrected it, and it's so good. And it's really apropos at this time of Black Lives Matter and all this crap about CRT, critical race theory. This is why I think it should be required viewing in schools. I remember a little bit the summer of 1969. And, you know, what we knew about Harlem was it was slums and there were riots and poor people and black people. And that is true. Remember, 1969 is the year after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, and there were riots everywhere in this country, and especially in black neighborhoods, obviously. But what I learned as a kid was, you know, Harlem was scary, it was black people, they were all on drugs, and it was dangerous. And then you see this film, and it's this wonderful series of concerts outside in a park in Harlem, and you look out from the stage, and there's 50 and 60,000 black people, almost exclusively, loving this music and peaceful and joyous and sweating because it's really hot. And it's not at all the narrative we were taught about what Harlem was or is. Kind of shocking to this white kid from northern Minnesota. And then, aside from that historical point, the music is unbelievable. There's young Stevie Wonder. There's Nina Simone, Mahalia Jackson, young Gladys Knight and the Pips. The Fifth Dimension, which, if it's not that year, it's the next year where Aquarius Let the Sunshine In, it is the number one record in the country, The Fifth Dimension. And it's in Technicolor, so their costumes or whatever, what they're wearing is like bright orange and neon green. And I mean, it's so cool to see the 60s in color in every way. I mean that. And then there's even a Chicago angle. The Staple Singers are there. And Mavis Staples, I just read this. They were called the Staple Singers, but their name is Staples. So Mavis Staples was the youngest daughter. There was the father and the three daughters made up the Staple Singers, gospel, R&B, soul. So she sort of has a little step out in this film where she connects with Mahalia Jackson and sort of steps in for her at one point and sort of gets ordained by the queen, Mahalia herself, to sing. And it's kind of thrilling to see. But the Staple Singers were from Chicago, the Staples family. So that's a kind of a nice connection. And then there's, of course, a whole bunch more famous people that I've never heard of or haven't heard of enough who just blow the top off the place, if there was a top on it. And it's a really, it's a wonderful film. So required viewing, Summer of Soul and The Beatles Get Back. I'm so happy to welcome my guest for today, Jeremy Kahn. He's a wonderful friend and colleague, and now we will entertain you. Ready? Entertain Jeremy Kahn.
Ba-da-ba-da-ba-ba. Hey, Sean.
Yeah, welcome. It's great to see you.
Thanks for having me. It's great to see you in 3D.
We haven't seen much of each other in 2 years.
It has been a minute. I have a question.
Okay.
So where's the camera?
Oh, well, there's seven of them, okay. So we'll get you from every angle.
Okay, I'm glad I'm wearing my best tuxedo.
It'll actually make you seem dimensional.
illusion of three dimensions.
Exactly. So for our background, we've actually done quite a few shows together.
We have. I was trying to think what the first one might have been.
That one I couldn't come up with either. Was it? It wasn't Wizard of Oz at Shakespeare.
That was pretty early in the game, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, we did a lot of Wicked, and we were like co-subs on Aladdin.
Yes, we were.
More recently. Mm-hmm. Did you play more than Joseph out at Paramount when I was conducting?
I did. Wasn't that an experience?
Yes. A few tales to tell about about that that maybe we shouldn't tell.
Actually, including an episode with my heart, because at that point I was having some issues with atrial fibrillation, and I did a gig out of town with Ife Butler, noted Chicago actress, and when I came back, I went into some episode, and it was right around opening night, I think.
And did you miss the show? I don't think you did.
I don't know. I think I pulled it together.
I think you missed the sound check and the maybe the band rehearsal. I think Carl Monska stepped forward and played your book.
Yeah, maybe it's all fuzzy, as many things are now.
Exactly. Like my conducting.
Oh, come on now.
Beautiful like that. So anyhow, we've done a lot together. Mm-hmm. But so what I'm more interested in is this sort of other world that, of course, I don't travel in at all. It's called jazz.
Ooh, look out now.
I'm doing the hands.
Yeah.
and that's your training, right?
It's my training. It is actually where... I would say it's my first love, but, too often to play the music that I love to play, I get subsidized with dozens of dollars, and and I have found that if I can sort of spread the net a little bit wider, then things work out best for me.
I feel like that's happened a lot in our Chicago musical theater world. When you get a regular gig, it lasts for a while and you make some money.
Right.
And even though it's not jazz players' love of doing it, it's nice to make a living.
It's as close to having a grown-up job as I've ever had. I'm thinking specifically about the run of Wicked, which lasted about 1,000 performances in one fell swoop and then came back for some other things.
Oh, so, that's right. We've done at least... Episode 3 9.
The tour has come back. And I look at it as, I've had jazzers say, oh, man, you're doing a show. I don't know how I could do that. I'd lose my mind with boredom, and you know, they would probably be happy to make the money.
Yes.
But aside from that, I look at it as just sort of a different skill set that's more about craftsmanship and all sorts of other things than it is about creativity. So it all sort of goes into the mix, I think.
Yeah, Linda and I talked about that in episode one. The
sounds
ability,
like Star Wars.
Exactly. We're doing them out of order. So that'll become episode seven eventually. But it's a really different skill set to try and play your best show 8 times a week.
Very much so. I mean, I just remember during Wicked sitting at my perch for keyboard 4, which really didn't have a whole lot of technically challenging things, but you know, there's so many bits of information that you can screw up at any given moment, and if you space out, it's like, well, how did I mess that up? I'm going to definitely nail that tomorrow. And then I'd come back and be ready for it. And then I go, you know, I better put some gas in the car. But when I go, oh, how did I mess that up again? Oh, my God.
Yeah. So the flip side of being totally relaxed about it is it's like you can wander off. I always thought of the keyboard books because, you know, that's what you and I play in the mm-hmm. pits as being there's usually you're just filling out and adding stuff. But
not
in
exposed,
certain books,
yeah.
I look at them as where are the places where I could stop the show?
I better pay attention.
You know, in Aladdin, there was that chord before A Whole New World.
Right.
You're the only one playing the brrrring. And it's like, okay, if you cack that one, you've ruined Aladdin.
You broke the show, yeah.
Yeah. And there were very few other places in that book where you could mess it up, but mm-hmm. you couldn't really stop it.
Right.
And then in Wicked, like keys 2 and 1, you could actually mess up the show frequently on those books because they were really busy.
Right. So you think, okay, this is just going to be a drive through wine country. I can just sort of cruise. And no, you have to really stay focused for the entire time. And
I enjoy it. I think it's a real test of a different kind of concentration.
Absolutely.
And the joy of being relaxed and just getting to play with your friends. You know, there's certain shows that are just so much fun because, I don't know, something weird happens or it's just sailing along and clicking.
Here's another interesting thing, I think, anyway, about that whole aspect is that pretty much every show I've ever done, save one or two, the business model is that you play it exactly the same way 8 times a week.
Yes.
Flip the coin on that. Every time I'm on a jazz gig and I play Embraceable You, let's say I've played it 1,000 times in my life, my goal is to play it slightly differently than before. So,
but here's the difference. I could play it and it would definitely be differently, but you play it differently with intention. And I'm a real admirer of what you do in that world because you have great relaxation, but variety in what you do. And tell me how that occurs. Can you teach that? Because you are teaching jazz now at Northwestern, right?
I teach at Northwestern.
Is it teachable?
And DePaul,
okay.
And Elmhurst. And
Lord,
yeah.
Everyone wants you.
Yeah. Why, oh, why was I blessed with this musical talent?
I think it's your alternate voicings in the left hand that really set you apart. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
That was some good jazz talk there.
Thank you.
You must have Googled it before.
But teaching it, so how did you learn it?
Well, teaching it, oh boy, that's a really involved question, and I got to be careful because a lot of my students are paying $80,000 a year, and I could just tell them, hey, listen to the past jazz icons, practice your instrument, and play music with good people, and thank you.
But we also know that it doesn't just occur.
No.
Not in most human beings.
Well, I think a lot of it is, to a large extent, it has to be a self-motivated journey, but there's guidance that can be given, and you know, maybe focus more on this than that, and make sure that you know you're listening to the other people as much as you're listening to yourself, because most of the time it's a group conversation.
Right. You know? So how did you learn to play jazz?
Well, pretty much what I just said. I started listening to records. And to this day, I seek out music that I think I'm going to enjoy listening to. And that, by definition, defines what I am as a musician. And then seek out players that are a little bit better than me so that my ass is getting kicked just enough that I'm motivated to get better, but not that they're not so much better than me that I'm completely terrified, which, you know, has happened.
We don't always get that choice.
That's true. Exactly. And then it's baptism by fire, and you hope that you emerge a stronger person on the other end of it.
I really admire the way jazz players are composing on the fly. It's a skill that's,
It's a funny skill set, and people chuckle when I describe it this way. But it's about damage control, really. You know, because as an improviser, you are hopefully playing something that you've never played before, and then you quickly assess: is this going someplace, or is this going to come off the rails? And before you have a really ugly incident, if you think it's not going where it ought to, you find a different direction.
And do you have safety zones you can fall back to?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, well, the word that I have flashing in neon in my brain, which can singe a little bit, is lyrical. So I'm trying to come up with a melody that I think does the original melody justice. But sometimes that muse deserts me, and then I fall back on sort of pattern-based things that I've come up with in the practice room and use that as connective tissue until the melodic muse chooses to reappear, if that makes sense.
But you need that stuff in your fingers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't just have the melody. I can play the melody.
Right. And different ways of approaching the melody. You can always tweak the melody. You can actually... There have been great examples. Thelonious Monk comes to mind, of people who just kind of keep altering the melody, and that's their solo. It is improvisation, because they keep massaging it in different ways. But you don't have to start from scratch. The melody is your friend.
Well, this is another question I have as a sort of non-jazz aficionado. I love when I go and I hear the standards and I hear an improvisation that's based on the song.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as much of a fan where I go and the improv solo is just a show off time, right? Has nothing to do with the tune. I mean, those can be thrilling too. Yeah. I'm not saying, I haven't heard some amazing people just go off, like What Planet Are They On, right?
Yeah.
Well,
here's the slippery slope that's not helped by academia. Musicians, jazz musicians, can fall into the trap of trying to impress each other.
Yes.
And we, by definition, don't really know what it is that non-musicians or non-jazz aficionados respond to, because we're not that. And we have to try to tune in without dumbing things down excessively. We have to try to tune in to what's the basic narrative? What does somebody respond to? And when they say, well, so jazz, you play the melody and then you just sort of like noodle aimlessly for a really long time and then you come back to the melody, is that how it works? And that's not how it works, and that you've kind of failed your mission if that's what's coming across. When I play solo piano gigs in restaurants, I don't do anything but play the melody, because it's a great way to practice a melody. Often in group situations, a piano player doesn't get to play the melody. That's the singer, that's the horn player. They get to do that, and we have to just sort of back them up. So it's a good chance for me to practice the melody, and then I'll like move it into different keys and try to make it sound not so boring and take two or three passes at it and then go on to the next song.
So here's another question, a naive question.
Yes, Sean.
So I have a lot of them in jazz. Do you like, are you one of those people like, oh, I'm going to do all the things you are. Oh, that's in D flat. And are there keys that songs are always in?
Yeah, there are standard keys in our sexist world. Most, 99% of the Great American Songbook was written for tenors. So when a female calls a tune, if All the Things You Are, for example, is usually in A flat, and if a female vocalist says, I want to sing All the Things You Are, really good bet that it's going to be in D flat or E flat. A fourth or a fifth away is kind of standard. And it's hilarious that so many singers says, they'll say, yes, that's my key. How did you know that? That is amazing. It's like, well, you know, but so yeah, there are standard keys. I've forgotten what a lot of them are because the more singers you play with, the chances are increased that you're going to play it in any and every key eventually.
But doesn't like going down a step, up a step, down a fourth, doesn't that blow out of the water some of where your fingers fit? Maybe that's ideal for you. Or do you just know the chord changes?
It does change it. And that's, you know, Sean, change is good.
I don't believe that shit.
I read it on a fortune cookie once. So
okay, all I see on fortune cookies now is there's life, there's more to life than money, Bitcoin,
there you go, or non-fungible things or whatever they are.
Yeah.
When again, me sitting at a restaurant playing a gig where I don't think anybody's listening, I say to myself, hey self, All the Things You Are, what would be a big pain in the ass key to play it in? All right, let's do it in, let's try it in B or G flat or D, and then just hang tough with the melody, kind of hang tough with what you think the chords are in that key. And often as not, I'll discover things that I've never played in the so-called easier keys. And it's like, wow, why didn't I ever think of that when I was playing it in A flat all those million times? So yeah, just the ergonomics of the keyboard. It's not a perfect invention. So yeah, when you play the same song in a different key, different things show up, and that's, you have to embrace that.
Yeah. I'm curious how you get there, because I could go to a restaurant and, you know, have a song in A flat and then say, I'm going to try it in Q flat diminished. And that's what it would sound like. So no one would want to pay to hear my discovery.
Yeah.
So did you, like, you're from the East Coast, right?
I am from Chicago, but you're darn close.
But your training, you went to school in the East, is that not true?
I did. Kind of a little side, when I was playing rehearsals for Wicked once, they brought in a woman from California to take over one of the roles, and we were chatting and she goes, so, Chicago, is that technically on the East Coast?
No.
Yes. And I said, well, you know, no. This is the Midwest. And she said the word Midwest like that was a term she had never heard.
Flyover land.
Yeah.
Wow.
But anyway, yeah, I ended up going to a music school in Boston and then moving to New York for 12 years after that. So I do have a lot of alpha, obnoxious East Coast in me.
But you were born here.
I was born in, I like to say, the hard scrabble streets. That's hard to say. The hard scrabble streets of southeastern Lake County.
Ooh.
Like if you know where Ravinia Festival is.
Oh, yeah. I think of life as being really tough there.
It was rough, yeah.
Okay. Did you go to, like, through high school here?
Yeah. And then
what high school did you go to?
Highland Park High School. Oh, okay. Actually, our high school graduation was on the stage of Ravinia.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was cool.
So you were destined for greatness.
Well, we'll see.
Go to Berkeley in Boston, or what were you?
Sean, please. I went to a New England conservatory.
I'm bowing right now, people, and apologizing. Yes.
What is it with people?
How little of me. did you graduate from there?
Yeah, I got my BM from a New England conservatory, which is kind of about what a college degree in music as well.
Yeah, I have a couple of BSs.
They're similar.
And more in real life.
Yeah.
So, okay. So then you go from there to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your New York life like?
Challenging, as everybody's is. I got really lucky in one regard that has kind of shaped my musical identity to this day, I would say. I got a call from a guy who said, this is Vince Giordano. I've got a band. We play 20s and 30s jazz. I've heard that you're a pretty good player. And can you read? And I said, yeah, I can read a little bit. And so I played in this band, and it still exists. A lot of the same guys are in it 40 years later. And I learned so much about the history of American popular song by being in this band. And he'd put charts out in front of me, and there would be what a jazzer loves, you know, chord symbols and slashes, and I'm just going boom chuck, boom chuck, boom chuck. Oh, this is easy, what fun. And then I turn the page, and then somebody's written out a transcribed piano solo by Fats Waller, and I'm supposed to sight read it because Vince knows all of these solos inside out. He doesn't want to hear your solo, he wants to hear Fats Waller's solo.
Oh.
And talk about baptism by fire. So,
oh, that would be horrifying.
Yeah, so I was in that band for 10 years, did a little bit of off-Broadway stuff, subbed on Broadway 4 or 5 times, Cats and Crazy for You. That was my Broadway career. But mostly I was with Vince Giordano and the Nighthawks and did what they call in New York club dates, which is hilarious. Somebody said, so do you want to do some club dates? And I was thinking, yeah, I'm in New York. I'm a jazz guy. That sounds great. And that's what we call jobbing here in Chicago, which means playing weddings or corporate events. It's right. Called a club date for some reason.
I was talking about that with Linda Van Dyke because she led a band or was in
that's
a
right.
band for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that world just kind of dried up all of a sudden with iPods and playlists, right?
Yeah, I think it has come back with a vengeance post-COVID. We'll see if it lasts. But yeah, there are still jobbing bands out there. Not as many as there used to be. There's not as many live music opportunities as there were. I mean, certainly 100 or 80 years ago, every big hotel had their own house big band. And every lounge had a trio or a quintet or something. You could lead a very solid middle-class existence. There's a great Hitchcock movie called The Wrong Man, where Henry Fonda plays bass in a big band at some hotel, and he gets accused of murder, and then the hilarity.
I've never heard of that, Hitchcock. The Wrong Man?
Yeah, it's kind of a minor one, but it's from the 50s, and it's really good.
Are you a filmy? Do you know a lot about movies?
More than some, less than others.
Oh, that's a great, fantastic,
evasive answer.
Exactly. Okay. Well, we're going to take a little break right now.
Phew.
And when we come back, I want to ask you a little bit about films, and I also want to ask you about who your favorite composers to play are, or if that even crosses your mind. So,
you know, you ask whatever you feel like asking. Sean.
Yeah. And I'm sure you'll answer or not.
That's true.
But however that goes, we are coming back.
Hey, thanks for coming, everyone.
Right after the interval.
Uh-oh, pressure.
Yeah. Today's interval is brought to you by, again, no one, but cool rock organ sound and nicely played, a major sixth.
Yeah, one of your popular intervals.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if it's the most popular, but let's say today it was.
I think it's trending.
And if it's not, people, let's get it trending on Twitter.
Let's go, people.
Major sixth. And yeah,
its time has come.
So you are a family man. I know you have two sons.
So they say.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And are they both doing well and working? I'm trying to remember.
They're doing great. One of them was born in 1990. I'll let people do the math on that. And that's Charlie. He lived in New Orleans for a long time. Really good Barry sax player who studied with your previous guest, Linda Van Dyke.
Oh, okay, cool.
He and his lovely girlfriend moved during the pandemic to lovely Asheville, North Carolina, which is really pretty.
Have you been there then?
Yeah, he's got bears in his neighborhood.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I mean, the animals.
Yeah.
Not like Mike Ditka or something. Moved
the fridge.
Did you guys go to...
Yeah, we should talk sports.
The mansion?
The Vanderbilt mansion? Yeah. Yeah, we drove up to it. I think it cost $75 to get a branch water.
If I'm going to pay for that, I'm going at Christmas when they decorate the whole place or something. I suppose that eliminates the gardens, but it's not the Vanderbilt mansion. What's it called?
I don't know. The
Biltmore Estate.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's Charlie.
Charlie and Luke was born in 1993. They were both born in Greenwich Village when we lived in New York. And Luke lives in Chicago, so I get to see him a little bit more, which is great. He was a fantastic trombone player. That's kind of on hold for a while. He managed a marijuana dispensary for several years, a true growth industry.
Yes.
And... now he's working at a Montessori school. So
okay,
they're good kids.
That's nice. I know you lost your wife, Marianne,
Marianna. You were one letter away.
I was five
years ago, yeah.
Five?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's...
That was no fun.
No, that was tough. Those are tough times.
It was during Wicked that she was... diagnosed, and I remember talking to a couple of guys in the band, just sort of like being like a zombie. It's like, well, you're not going to believe the news I just got. But she fought it for 10 years and had some really productive windows in there, but eventually...
Well, she was an artist herself.
Yes, we met in the world of theater.
Mm-hmm.
I hired her. I was a musical director, and she was an actress. And we did Baby and Godspell together.
Was she a belter?
Yeah. She had a beautiful voice and was a great actress. She studied with Uta Hagen in New York City. And
okay.
she was really good at it. But eventually what was her favorite part? And I thought she would say, you know, being on stage. And she really liked to rehearse more than anything else. And then she liked the performances. But what she really, really didn't like was auditioning and marketing herself. And that's what led to her exit from the business, I would say.
Yeah, but then she worked and did costumes and everything else.
Yeah, it's interesting. Years later, when Charlie and Luke were in middle school, she hooked up with this theater program that was year-round. She started off as a volunteer mom costume designer, and it turned into a year-round gig where she was paid and... with her expertise in theater, all aspects of theater, they were really lucky to have had her there.
I think of that often. Like, I have fantasies of going back to Brainerd, Minnesota, and like taking over the drama department at high school. But I think schools that get a professional level person who's just out of that part of the business but still has a passion for the art gets so lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just can up the production values, the level of aspiration, because there's somebody who knows how it's supposed to go.
Right, and it works for everybody. I mean, Marianna was so gratified that there were these kids that discovered the joy of of theater. And so she got a lot out of it, too.
Yeah. And without some of the bullshit we put up with in the professional world.
Exactly.
You know, it's, I've done a few amateur things when I've been a pro, and it's like, oh, it's such a good reminder that people do it for fun.
Yeah, well, the etymology of amateur is that you're doing it for the love of it. So,
how dare you drop language like that on me? It's my podcast. I'm going to edit that out. Makes me sound stupid. So back to this discussion of outside of what we do. So you like movies. You and I are Cubs fans, or you're a Cubs fan, and I'm...
I was thinking about this in the car, is that we both share sort of an unconditional love for our normally hapless local teams. You know, you as a Minnesotan, I was trying to think, when's the last time they had a professional champion up there?
Well, I told Linda I've given up all sports because I realized everyone loses, except for one team. Or one player,
right?
In sports, you're all losers except for one.
That's,
and if Minnesota,
works, yeah.
You know, the one is not you. Yeah, I think the last, the women's basketball team, the Lynx, have won like 5 championships, but I haven't lived there in that era. So right. I think the Twins in '91 was maybe the last thing. And you know, I died many deaths through
Vikings,
four Super Bowl losses in 10 years or something.
Yeah, the Bears. Bears have never even been in 4 Super Bowls. So,
right, but more recently than us.
Yeah.
But so you grew up Bears, Cubs.
Bears, Cubs, Bulls, and you know, if the Blackhawks are doing well, I'm happy to jump on the bandwagon. But
I was a good bandwagoner for the Blackhawks and the Bulls,
right?
Because of course, if you lived in Chicago's in the '90s and you had Jordan and Pippen and Rod, what's not to jump on?
Yeah, it was phenomenal.
That was, even as a transplant, that was thrilling.
Yeah.
And the Blackhawks, that was fun too. When Taves and Kane were in their, you know, glory.
Yeah, they were great teams. And you know, as a jazzer, I suppose what I really like about watching sports, I really can't stand how wagering has sort of infiltrated into the whole structure. But I like watching something that's never happened before, and you never know what's going to happen. And maybe the team that you're rooting for is going to win. Possibly, probably not. But there should be a few moments of really potentially breathtaking beauty in there.
Maybe I am a jazzer. That's part of why I watch live sports. I'm like, it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
So anything can happen. Mm-hmm. And also, in the world of HDTV, live sports looks amazing on these flat screen TVs.
That's
like,
true.
You're in the football huddle. It's almost like you're the football during the pass. You
right.
know,
these athletes
so cool.
just do amazing things.
Yeah. So amazing that we forget how amazing it is sometimes. It's like, okay, my body never did do that or work.
Right.
Yeah, I watched more of the Olympics than I had intended due to an excessive amount of free time.
Mm. You're a big luge guy, right?
Yes, I think it's luge.
Oh.
Do you say luge?
You know, an anagram of luge is glue.
That makes no sense because it's like the opposite of glue.
Yeah. Or elug. I'll stop.
Yes, thank you so much. I have something to ponder later. I found it was weird to watch. You know, we're in China. We're not getting along with China.
The politics of it always seem to leach in.
I think, and I'm a big Olympics fan, but I think it's just too damn huge now.
Yeah.
The fact that one place is supposed to host all of this at the same time and everybody goes there, I think it loses its impact now. And now that there's more than 3 television choices, no one watched it this year.
It's not what the Greeks had in mind 2,000 years ago? Or
well, maybe? I would have watched the Greeks because they were all naked, I think, right? Wasn't
hubba hubba.
Well, you know, I can see problems with the marathon and a few other events.
Luge.
Yeah, because they did that on actual marble.
Right.
You know, that wasn't that
your butt would smooth. Stick to that thing.
But so do you have hopes for the Cubs this year?
Not really.
It's
now they're sort of in, we don't say the word rebuild, but that's kind of where they are these days. The White Sox are the exciting team.
I have to say, even as a Twins fan, I was kind of on board with the White Sox last year. They mm-hmm. were exciting. They played good baseball.
Yeah, they've got some very compelling people on there. And, you know, I'm a Cubs fan. If you are a true Chicagoan, well, why can't we root for both teams? No, it's kind of the law. You pick for one.
I still hate the Bears.
You pick one team.
I love how awful they are as a Vikings fan.
Well, but we both hate the Packers. So
even more these days. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole other three-drink thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really hate the monetization of it.
Well, and that, you know, a lot of my friends have stopped giving money to the Cubs organization because their politics are pretty heinous, and I've remained steadfast in being able to compartmentalize. No, I love baseball. I love the Cubs. And, you know, tell me what major sports owner has politics that align with my own, probably none.
All of them that own teams now are billionaires, so likely to be Republicans.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I just find it egregious that one of the Ricketts was Trump's re-election campaign manager, and
that's pretty bad.
Galls me.
Yeah.
And even though you have to, you know, separate that from Javi Baez and Rizzo and Chris Bryant. Oh. Mm. All former club. Do we know any of them anymore? Who are they? Name one.
Well, from the championship, you still have Wilson Contreras and Kyle Hendricks. That's probably it. Oh, and Jason Hayward.
Okay. Yeah, that was an interesting sidelong glance you just gave me.
Anybody can have a bad century.
I've been watching some of the NCAA stuff. Kind of fun to see St. Peter's.
You know, I lived in Jersey City for 4 years. I never heard of St. Peter's University or whatever it's called, but so good for them.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
There's always got to be a Cinderella in the tournament. So.
It's the only thing that really makes it interesting. I mean, no one wants Kentucky or UCLA or Duke to
Certainly
win anything
Duke, yeah.
ever again.
Right.
I mean, maybe people do, but...
If you went there, you know.
Yeah, it's just not interesting to me. Here's what I enjoy about you.
Uh-oh.
I really liked your YouTube channel where you sit down and you play a couple of tunes.
Oh, yeah.
You choose a composer or a theme or something.
It's usually a composer, yeah.
And how much do you work your way through that? Or is that just a sort of like, you know, I like these two. I think they fit together. And it's like my cocktail bar gig. I'm going to try it.
Well, let's see. Yeah, I'll pick a composer that I love. And a lot of times it's just two songs. Sometimes it's more. But if I do two songs, I want to do something perky and then something sensitive because I do have a very deep and sensitive side to me.
Oh, I don't think we have time for that this week. But
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well, I try not to bring on Debbie Downers on my program. You know, or not yet, but so favorite composers, are there people that their music fits in your fingers or in your head? Do you?
Well, I have kind of two lists going, and there should be more, but one is Great American Songbook, and by that I mean Richard Rodgers, Cole Porter, Harold Arlen, Irving Berlin, Jimmy Van Heusen, people like that. All of these composers have at least a dozen songs that I really love to play. And then I have sort of a jazz icon composer, say Duke Ellington or Antonio Carlos Jobim, Wayne Shorter, Charles Mingus, blah, blah, blah. And again, each of them I've chosen because they have a body of work that contains at least a good sampling of stuff that I love to play.
Okay. When I'm playing auditions, which I don't do anymore, by the way, I hate it when someone brought in Cole Porter because it's like, he's harmonically really complicated and all this chromatic stuff.
Right.
And
well, I hate when they bring in Sondheim.
Well, there.
It's like, usually I can look at a piece of music and sort of assign chord symbols to them and then like BS my way through. But Sondheim's language is so...
you can't generalize it.
Right. And often it's written awkwardly, like he was just doing some sort of cute crossword puzzle or something, which I know he was into.
Yeah, he was into puzzles. I remember when the very first time they were doing Into the Woods here in Chicago, it was so long ago that it was a joint venture between Candlelight and Marriott.
Oh, my.
And I ended up playing a lot and a lot of those auditions. And I remember really clearly a kid coming in, and he was going to sing Not a Day Goes By from Merrily We Roll Along.
We don't say day-go anymore.
I'm sorry. Not a day goes by.
Oh, I misunderstood.
That's right. Yes. So, but on his music, it said in D or something, and it's in F. And he goes, oh, yeah. My teacher
He wanted you to transpose Sondheim?
Yeah, yeah. He said, my teacher said that I do it in D. I'm like, not recommended. He goes, well, I said, I will try, but, you know, he goes, yeah, I'm okay. So we try it. And Kevin Stites, do you know Kevin?
He
was music directing.
I met him a few times, yeah.
Still a big music director in New York and L.A., I think.
Did he stop you?
Well, no, but afterwards, and the kid left the room, he goes, what? I said, I was transposing. He goes, oh, thank God, I thought you were having a stroke. I said, believe me, the kid wouldn't do it in the... I said, I was trying to transpose that song on the fly, and it was a nightmare, and of course...
I played an audition for somebody once who laid the music out, and I said, now, at the beginning, I'd like to start, if we could, I'd like to start Rutabo.
What is Rutabo? Is it something?
Well, I think that they meant to say rubato, which actually is something.
Okay.
And I thought, I bet that they mean rubato. And I look at the piece of music, and sure enough, there it said, R-U-T-A-B-O, Rutabo. It must be slightly different from rubato.
I think it's more root-based.
Yeah, rutabaga.
Like rutabaga kind of idea. Are you into any of the like streaming services? Are you... into Ozark or, you know, Bridgerton or?
Not as much as a lot of people. I do enjoy Mrs. Maisel.
Yeah. Rachel Brosnahan is a Highland Park girl.
That's right.
Do you know any of her people?
I don't. And she's one of the few non-Jews from Highland Park, yet she's cast as a Jew, which is like a whole other
hilarious
thing. So
she's fantastic though.
she's great, and I love the soundtrack. They picked great music of that era.
The cast is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I haven't even watched all of season two. I'm the opposite of a binger. If I like a show, I drag it out.
I was so sad when Schitt's Creek ended.
Yes, although that was a fantastic ending.
Yeah.
When we were doing Wicked, it was around the time of Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And I didn't start that till kind of later. And then I really got into it. And then when it was the last season and I had like 10 episodes left, I would watch one a month or something because I didn't want it to be done instead of racing to the end.
You want to hear my true confessions about Breaking Bad?
Okay.
The only episode I watched was the final one. Luke and Mariana had dutifully worked their way through the entire thing, and I sat on the couch with them being such an annoying mofo. So why don't we like her? And, who was that? Will you just shut up?
I would have shot you. Did it make any sense to you?
Not really. I was just there for the hang, you know.
And that's the only one you've ever seen?
Yeah.
I mean, I admit it's not for everybody. It's pretty damn violent.
I remember Jim Wardlowski saying, yeah, this show, it's great, really intense.
Yeah.
I just was amazed that it was the same actor that had been in Malcolm in the Middle, which I thought was a great show. So
that's some good range.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So any of the other things that you're into?
On TV?
Yeah.
No, you know, between sports, watching sports... And actually, I'm the guy who gets Netflix DVDs sent to him in the mail.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're the one left.
Uh-huh. And I have this long queue, and things show up in the mail. I put them on the queue like a year ago, and I try to figure out why it was that I chose this, and then I committed to it a year ago, so I watch it. So I think they have a better selection with older movies and foreign and indie movies than they do Scream. I think if I only did the streaming thing, I would like scroll for 20 minutes and then I'd go, oh, I don't feel, I'm tired, I'm going to go to bed. And it's like, so.
Yeah, it happens. Do you read? Do you like read books?
Not as much as I should, but yes, I do.
Favorite kind of genre that you do?
I try to go back and forth between fiction and nonfiction, and try to have a fair amount of things about music. There's an amazing book by the composer Alec Wilder. It's called The History of American Popular Song or something like that, because I'm sort of a nerd for that, and he was a much bigger nerd, and I'm learning some stuff.
Is he the New York Times guy?
No.
I'm trying to remember. I have a book called And All the Rest Is Noise. It's about classical music, about the pieces you have to, and it's a New York Times guy, but I'm blanking
on.
Yeah,
don't know. I don't think it's the same guy.
So, yeah, I like to read. I don't do it as much as I should now.
My problem is that I have a TV in my bedroom.
Oh, yeah. Oprah said you can't do that.
Well.
You don't. Of course, she also gave us Dr. Oz and Dr. Phil, so she's...
Take it with a grain of salt.
So she isn't flawless. Mm-hmm. So we moved this interview a little bit because you picked up a gig.
I did.
Just like last minute.
I did.
So tell me, A, what is a gig and how do you get them?
A gig is a professional musical opportunity here in the gig economy.
Wow.
Oh, go figure. I've found myself just in a network, a pool of musicians. And, this is actually my friend, pianist Steve Million. You know, one of the best ways I found to get gigs is to suck up to the people that play your instrument, tell them, hey, if you ever get a hangnail, I'd love to fill in for you. And so I got a text from Steve this morning saying, you open tonight? And I was. So I'll go play the jazz music with a wonderful singer and a wonderful bass player for 3 hours at a restaurant, and maybe a couple people will listen to us, and I'll get some free food out of it, and it'll be a beautiful thing.
Yeah, the life of a musician.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's all...
There's an official term when you play a wedding gig and they say, oh, we'll feed you. And it usually ends up being a 3-day-old wet turkey sandwich and a cookie. And that's called a bandwich.
Of course it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Jeremy, it's been, speaking of the gig, you got to get there. So it's been a pleasure speaking with you. And yeah, we have to.
I guess we're wrapping it up. Is that how they say it?
I was trying to think of the version of Rutabo that would have been accelerando, but I wasn't quick enough for that. Yeah, we're wrapping it up. But it's been a pleasure. It's always great to talk with you, and it's great to see you in person.
Ditto. Yeah, this was fun.
And if, you know, maybe someday we'll do a show together again. That would...
The Sunshine Boys.
Yeah. Which
on ice.
On ice. Everything on ice.
Uh-huh.
That's exactly. So, all right. Cheers. Great Bye-bye. To talk with you.
Shalom.
Out. That was fun.
You got enough?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, then we covered some turf.
Yeah. Not all of it professional. Right. Because that. Oh, good timing, Dexter!